opportunity to show yourself or prove yourself.
Well, yes, I did. I suppose, since this is a recording of what happened, I should note that during the Navigio Canal battle, I won the Military Cross, leading the rifle company, leading Charlie Company. Mm-hmm. And so this is some kind of a symbol of the fact that I was able to do it confidently.
I guess that is as good as anything to prove your ability. Given the fact that, as you say, this was leading up to your last active action, this series of battles, what, to the best of your memory, what are your most vivid memories from that time? Exultation, fear?
Well, they say that the battle is 99% boredom and 1% terror. And I think that's probably pretty close to the truth. I think the most memorable occasion I can remember is the crossing of the Navigio Canal. We started off with two officers in the company. He was commanding the lead platoon. I was commanding the company from behind the lead platoon with my company headquarters. He was wounded very early on, and the company was bogged down by machine gun fire that was firing across the road on fixed lines in the dark. There was nothing really very much we could do about it except either quit and go back or carry on to our objective. And since the first choice was not really a choice, since nobody in my regiment would ever think of using it, I got up and worked my way forward to the lead platoon where the leading platoon commander had recently been wounded, and got into a slight ditch on the side of the road and started a charge down the road. And I was running along, and the next thing I knew, I found myself tumbling head over heels into a German machine gun post that I hadn't seen at all. I just stepped into it and barged into them, and I was thrashing around, and they were thrashing around and everything.
They were shot at you, obviously.
I was subsequently surprised to note that I had been labeled, I guess, as heroic for having charged a machine gun nest, but I can assure you it was an entire accident in the middle of the night, even though it did result in taking out the machine gun.
during this this period, you also became, and I find this interesting personally, the intelligence officer for the unit, and I'm just curious as to how this came about, first of all, and what did that position or role perhaps require of you that other roles did not, such as instructional roles? Was there any special aspect of being an intelligence officer that required something a little extra?
Well, I don't know how it came about, except that while the regiment was out of the line for a period, we weren't always fighting. Occasionally the whole division would come out of the line and do training in the rear areas, and occasionally brigades would come out of the line, or battalions would come into reserve, and they would be in reserve for maybe a week or 10 days. One of the periods when we came out of the line, I was sent off to the Central Mediterranean Intelligence School at a place called Lido de Raya, outside of Naples. And the course was a 10-day course, I think, something like that. Anyway,
who would be running that?
That was run by the British Army. Actually, I see it was a 3-week course. It was fabulous because we were just about 15 kilometers outside of Naples, which was a very attractive city, and we worked very hard the day, and we played very hard all night long, and came back and worked very hard in the day. So it was a very exhausting 3 weeks, but very interesting. We refought some of the battles from an intelligence viewpoint and watched how intelligence was built up and how you went about building up intelligence and fitting it together. When I came back from that course, I went back to my rifle company and soldiered on for just until really the one of the last battles of the battalion campaign. And when we started what was called Operation Goldflake to move the 1st Division across to join its brothers in Northwest Europe, I was appointed to intelligence officer of the battalion. And that was very interesting because I was one of the few officers of the battalion who was allowed to leave the very closely restricted camps and the route along which we traveled. And I was able to see something of the countryside. Whenever I wanted to see something of the countryside that perhaps I couldn't justify too much, I could always claim I was lost. So I got a reputation of being a very poor map reader as an intelligence officer, even though I never actually led the battalion astray. I several times led myself astray.
And a German machine gun nest, no doubt. with respect to intelligence, I think everybody sort of has their own perhaps preconceptions of intelligence, sort of shadowy figures in the night and whatnot. With intelligence, so, you know, after you were informed that this was to be your role for a short period, did the subsequent training change your views of intelligence at all, or did it sort of more or less meet up with your expectations?
Well, battle intelligence is entirely different from, if you like, the spy kind of intelligence that takes place at a very high level and far, far behind the lines. Battle intelligence is merely the task of systematically correlating all the information that comes into the battalion from various sources, from patrols, from artillery, observation posts, from formations on the right and the left, from divisional headquarters, intelligence summaries coming down, and having correlated all this, put it into some kind of a digest so your commanding officer knows what kind of an enemy is in front of him, what kind of opposition he's likely to get, and that's the intelligence part of it. The other part of it was rather mechanical. I had to distribute all the maps that the battalion used, all the air photographs that the battalion used, and all the aids to interpreting and using maps, air photographs, and so on. And that was a difficult job. That took a lot of time, too, because we were moving rather rapidly, and we used a lot of maps and a lot of air photographs.
Mm-hmm. Did the role of an intelligence officer, did it require certain demands upon you that other roles perhaps did not?
Yes, it did. It demanded, amongst other things, that I write the war diary. And I had a reasonably good education and was more or less articulate and literate and could write well, but the intelligence officer sometimes had to work very, very late at night. There were no 9 to 5 hours or anything like that. You'd finish your normal job and then you'd have to get maps out and then you'd have to get air photos out and you'd have to paste them into mosaics and you'd have to annotate them and overprint them and do things of this nature. And I found I worked very, very long hours, perhaps not as physically active as I was as a platoon commander. Then I had to write up the war diary each day. And I became a little careless with the war diary on one occasion. I remember my colonel, who was born in England and went to an English public school and has impeccable English. He still lives in Victoria, British Columbia, by the way, Colonel J.R. Stone, DSO and Bar MC, and a splendid fellow. Called me in one morning while I was a bit groggy from waking up with a very short night's sleep and read me a lecture on how to use English properly. And I blushed and blushed, and from there on I spent much more care with the war diary each day. But that's one of the troubles I had with it.
By the middle of April, 1945, April 19th, exact. You found yourself in Holland, where you were wounded in the shoulder, and through VE Day, you spent that happy day in the hospital, and were promoted to the rank of captain. Once out of hospital, you trained in Holland for action with what was tentatively referred to as the Canadian Berlin Brigade. In essence, what was the intent of this unit, and did it actually ever see service? Was it actually formed?
Do you mind if I just
sure.
Do a little before that? The battle in Holland was a very interesting battle. It's the first time we saw a concentration camp, amongst other things. We liberated one of the concentration camps, and it was a horrifying sight. The next thing
is... At that point, of course, and you had no idea that they existed.
No, we really had no idea that they existed. Well, we were aware, I was aware, even as a schoolboy, that concentration camps existed in Germany where people were sent for disagreeing with Hitler. That was probably one of the things that justified our fighting the war. But I'd never realized what went on in them until I saw this concentration camp in Holland. The next thing I'd like to say about the battle in Holland, we had a tendency to swan around. Now, swanning was the phrase we used because we behaved much like an enraged swan, stuck our neck out and attacked on a very narrow front. And we moved fairly rapidly in Holland. We had few major battles. We had a lot of minor skirmishes from rear guards and things of that nature.
And German units left behind to cause trouble.
And the day I was wounded, we were out of contact with the enemy altogether, but we had to send a major fighting patrol down a roadway to see if we could regain contact with the enemy and clear the road. And myself and the scout officer were at battalion headquarters, And one of us were going to go with this fighting patrol, so we tossed a coin to see which one would go with the fighting patrol and which one would go on a bath parade, because there was also a mobile laundry and bath unit down the road, and people were going down there. And I either won or lost the toss, as the case may be, and I went with the fighting patrol. We were clearing a roadblock, and I was standing beside the command carrier, which was firing a Browning machine gun down the road. The spent casings of the Browning machine gun were occasionally bouncing off the side of the carrier, and one or two of them had come close to me, and suddenly I felt a thump in the shoulder, and I thought I'd been hit by a spent casing from the Browning machine gun, so I just moved slightly to get out of the way of the casings, and I realized that my whole left side was very strangely numb. And then I did what I said I would never do, and which I'd seen people do so many times, and thought, how foolish. I grabbed myself on the left-hand side, felt the numbness, looked astonished at the person next to me, and said, I've been hit. And subsequently went to hospital.
What was it, sniper fire?
This was sniper fire from down the road. They finally decided they would fire some back at us.
Mm-hmm. Talking to other Army personnel connected with this program who were in the area, in the Low Countries, many of them mentioned that there was a surprising number of pro-German sympathizers in that area. Did you encounter anyone in that regard in Holland?
We never encountered any German sympathizers that were really free to roam around. The Dutch and the Canadians referred to these German sympathizers as muffs. I don't know what it means in Dutch. But
it's not very complicated.
Yeah, the muffs, anyways, were under surveillance, and some of them were being treated rather roughly by the pro-Allied resistance in Holland. Certainly none of them had any influence on our operations, and I never heard of any of these pro-German Dutchmen actually taking up arms against the Allies at all. Some of them, particularly the females who'd been friendly with Germans, had their hair shaved off, and you could see them on the streets.
Yes.
You could determine which was which.
Mm-hmm. But overall, you didn't find too much of it.
We found the Dutch very welcoming, delighted to see us, and throwing open their houses, doing everything they possibly could to welcome us.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned just a few minutes ago that you were ultimately in Holland training with this Canadian Berlin Brigade.
Yeah.
What was the intent? This sounds like an occupation brigade, essentially. Was it ever actually formed? Did it actually see Berlin?
Well, the intention was to send a brigade, a composite brigade of all Canadian forces, to Berlin to march through the streets in a victory parade in Berlin at the end of the war. And the Loyal Infantry Regiment was selected as the battalion from the 1st Canadian Division. And we trained at a place called Almelo in Holland, or in the area of Almelo and The Hague, to join this brigade and go to march to Berlin. But eventually the operation was scaled down until only a Canadian battalion went to Berlin to take part in the victory celebration, and one of the companies of the Loyal Edmonton was in that Berlin battalion.
Any idea why it was scaled down? Was it anything to do with political wheelings and dealings between Americans and Russians? You often see the newsreel footage of the period with the two, and I guess the British as well, all coming together.
I have no idea why it was scaled down, because before it went to Berlin, I had been posted back to Canada to join the Pacific Force, but I understood later from secondhand sources that the problem was logistic rather than any other problem, that Berlin was so badly battered, and the difficulties of finding accommodations for very large numbers of troops in Berlin, particularly since the Russians owned quite a large part of it and weren't too anxious to provide these facilities. Mm-hmm. I understand that's the reason why it was scaled down in size from the Allied side, if you like.
Mm-hmm. As you just mentioned, you were ultimately posted back to Canada, August 1945. You were still with the Loyal Edmonton Regiment through demobilization. And I'm just wondering, before we get to the post-war portion of your career, although you remained in the armed forces, obviously, how did you find demobilization in the period thereafter, adjusting to peacetime, going back to Canada? Demobilization occurred very quickly within the Canadian forces in terms of manned equipment being pared down and let go. Did you find the adjustment period difficult for you personally?
Well, I went back to Canada first to join the Canadian Army Pacific Force. That is the 3rd Battalion, the 2nd Canadian Infantry Regiment, which was at Camp Shiloh, Manitoba, training to go out to Japan. And while we were there training to go out to Japan, of course, VJ Day came along. The atom bomb was dropped and Japan capitulated. And so we disbanded that particular battalion. Since I was adjutant of that battalion, I had something to do with disbanding it. It appeared to me that we disbanded the Canadian Army by just simply reversing the procedures we used for forming the Canadian Army. And it was fairly simple. It was a bit rough cut. Some people, no doubt, who deserved to get out a few weeks early because of their long service and their number of wounds were held a little longer than some people who may have been retreaded zombies who got out first. There was some dissatisfaction with it, particularly in England, where they had riots in Aldershot. Mm-hmm. And they had some riots in Halifax, but where I was operating, there was never any trace of that. There was a few muttered dissatisfactions with it, but generally speaking, it was quick and painless demobilization.
Mm-hmm. Did you find, a lot of soldiers, seamen, airmen, talk about the adjustment to peace? Now, I realize you stayed in the forces for a very long time afterwards, but did you find that adjustment? Was there a transition period where it was difficult for you, or did you manage to adjust fairly smoothly?
Oh, I had really no adjustment to make. I had a fair amount of spare time while the dust was settling down and new units were organized, and I had a number of spotty little jobs, but not unlike wartime activities. Mm-hmm. And so there was no problem that I had with it. And soldiers are a great crew to grumble. They grumble about anything. The only time I ever get worried about soldiers is when I hear nobody grumbling. And I think perhaps Barry Broadfoot's book, as well as anything, describes some of the grumbling that took place by people who were demobilized. Mm-hmm. I stayed on in the Canadian Interim Force and was finally accepted for the regular force, so I wasn't demobilized. I was simply shifted around from pillar to post a bit while, as I say, the dust was dying down.
Mm-hmm. And some of those shifts included being posted to the PPCLI.
That's right.
In Shiloh, Manitoba, as, I believe, the transport officer.
Yes, I...
And you stayed with them until 1946, until he moved to Calgary?
Yes, I came to Edmonton to march with the Loyal Edmonton Regiment on its demobilization parade, marched the last mile with them and fell out with them, and then I reported to Calgary to the PPCLI, which was the only Western regiment that was going to remain in the regular force at that time. Mm-hmm. Since I'd been accepted in the regular force and was a Westerner, mm-hmm. I was delighted to be posted to the PPCLI, and I joined them gladly. I was appointed transport officer. Probably on the strength of the document, which showed I'd taken the transport course 2.5 years earlier in England, and I enjoyed that very much.
You stayed with them until they moved to Calgary in 1946.
That's right. I joined them in Shiloh and helped move them to Calgary. Right.
I think one of the, looking at your record, one for me is one of the more interesting posts that you attained was 1948, I believe. You were posted to the Director of Military Intelligence in Ottawa. As GSO3, and you were the adjutant to the Chief of Military Intelligence. I presume that posting was at least in part a consequence of your earlier intelligence activities or contacts.
I expect so. The way these things work, people have a tendency to look at your documents and say, oh, he was an intelligence officer and he took an intelligence course. We have a vacancy for an intelligence staff officer in Ottawa. We have to fill it. Send him. And that's the way you go. They certainly, nobody ever asked me whether I wanted to go to Ottawa. I was simply issued the posting. I might say that when I was speaking to you earlier, I forgot one very important part of my career. When I left the PPCLI in 1946, I actually went to the Royal Canadian School of Infantry at Camp Borden in Calgary, where I was an instructor and adjutant of the school until I went to the Director of Military Intelligence in 1949, as I check my documents now, instead of 1948.
I did notice that, yeah. I was just trying to wave it in here. Was there, as you say, you didn't have any option to go to such a posting, but was there, now this is military intelligence, post-war period now, is this similar to the type of intelligence work you would have done in Italy, or was it something a bit more broad? This would be more broad.
No, this is the high-level intelligence stuff. I wasn't actually a spy, and of course Canada has never had any spies. There have been Canadian spies, but working for British or American intelligence and so on. You know, everybody's probably read about Sir William Stevenson's intrepid affair, which, as far as I'm concerned, is largely garbage. It simply doesn't ring true to anybody who's had anything to do, really, with intelligence. It's an astonishing story, and I'm in no position to judge the actual incidents, but it doesn't ring true to me.
Was there any particular aspect of this type of intelligence, as you say this was very broad-based and at the highest level, was there any particular aspect about it that you found particularly fascinating or interesting?
Well, I think probably at this late stage of the game, some of the things that I couldn't talk about, I can talk about now. I'm still officially bound by the Official Secrets Act on one or two aspects of it, but the most, one of the more interesting projects that was being done in military intelligence was trying to build up the interior Soviet order of battle from the various sources that were available to it. Everything from wireless intercepts to unclassified information found in Newsweek or Time magazine. There was a great wide variety of sources that came in, sources of information which had to be checked, some against one against the other, and trying to build up what the size of the Russian forces
are. Using sources like that, I guess partly, that was part and parcel due to the fact that it would be then, and I guess now, even more so now, difficult to get agents inside the Soviet Union, or get hard evidence.
Well, yeah, but it's, again, I say Canada, at least while I was with intelligence, never employed any agents in any foreign countries, and consequently, any information we got from agent sources was either from the British or the U.S. Source, because they're very careful about protecting their sources. They wouldn't tell us what the source is. They might tell us what the intelligence item was. So you have no idea what came from agents and what came from other sources. But anyways, this was one of the interesting high-level aspects of it. The same kind of thing was going on, trying to find out about what the various forces were in the Far East. We had Far East Desk, as we called it, which, if I recall correctly, was MI9. We had a Soviet or Red Bloc desk, which was called MI7. We had an interior security desk, which largely worked with the RCMP, who at that time, for all purposes, were the counterintelligence force, which was called MI5. And we had MI organization and training, and we had a couple of small other little tiny branches that did specialized work from time to time.
And again, I presume your organization would be based a lot on the British model.
No. It had superficial similarities, but the British model was a very much more active thing that built up over a long period of time. I never did serve in British intelligence, but I did, when I served in Canadian intelligence, I served with an officer who subsequently served in British intelligence while I was serving in the War Office, and we frequently had lunch together, and occasionally we had little chats together, and again, without any particular security thing, he was able to tell me that the British intelligence office was very much more an active intelligence gathering organization than the Canadians were. We had very few sources of intelligence. We were largely a collating agent of intelligence we received from allies or from...
Would that be by choice or predicated on budget?
Budget, probably. You know, intelligence is quite an expensive game. And I think our internal security forces were quite useful and provided a lot of information on our internal situation. But as again, I say that was an RCMP force in those days. We had no military people working on
it. You mentioned the various desks, so to speak, on the Soviet bloc, presumably China as well. Given the fact that this is 1948, Berlin blockade is occurring or is about to occur, did you find it... professionally, an exciting period with respect to East versus West? Did you find it a very stimulating environment?
I found it professionally interesting because, as I say, I was the GSO3, Staff Officer Grade 3, of the whole of the intelligence department of the MI, the actual intelligence handling department called MI intelligence. And consequently, I had access to the Far East desk, the Soviet desk, the whole organization. And I found it very interesting to see what was coming in from what places, how our allies were reacting to various things. And I think if I'd been a worker on a desk, I'd have found it very much less rewarding, much more boring, because their tendency was to read all the newspapers, all the press, clip all the intelligence summaries that came in, and laboriously build up and collate files of information, which every now and again they studied thoroughly and tried to deduce something from. And that was a fairly boring operation.
Yeah.
My part of it was interesting.
I
looked after the military attachés too, amongst other things, and published our own Canadian intelligence review that the Canadian Army published.
Mm-hmm. After spending some time in Ottawa, Korea, of course, rolls around in 1950. You were assigned to GSO-3 Operations for Canadian Brigade, which was to embark to Korea. Yet you missed that entirely, that action. Rather interesting reason.
Well, I was all ready to go when somebody checked my intelligence clearances and found out that I'd had a very high specialized clearance. I don't know what it's worth now, but in those days you weren't allowed to be placed in any position with that clearance where you were liable to be captured by the enemy until you'd been 2 years out of the job. So my posting to Korea was canceled. And of course the Korean War for all purposes was over in 2 years, so I never did get out to Korea.
Presumably that two-year limit would mean that after the expiration of that time, whatever knowledge you had would be superseded by other knowledge.
That's right. It would be either out of date or they assumed, and probably rightly, that 2 years as long as you could hope to keep it out of the Russian hands anyway. They'd already have it by then.
After that posting, in 1951-52, you went to the British Army Staff College, which I believe you mentioned
right.
A little bit earlier. While there you were promoted, or during this time you were promoted to the rank of major. And you were briefly attached to the British Army of the Rhine as an operations officer with the Armored Brigade. You were also a Canadian Army liaison officer for land warfare. Land air warfare, excuse me. What was the feeling going back to Europe again? And I gather, you know, we are at the height of the Cold War, we're getting very close to it. Going back in a potentially hostile situation, was this kind of an eerie feeling?
No, there was no real feeling of hostility in Europe. In fact, we were, in those days, NATO was substantially, with its nuclear arsenal, safe. There was not much danger of any war breaking out in Europe, so it was very safe indeed.
Mm-hmm.
I might mention a couple of things that might be interesting for people who are studying this later on, is that I went to Staff College as a result of writing Staff College entrance examinations, which were standard throughout the Army. They were competitive. Every officer who wanted to go to Staff College had to qualify on them, and then had to be selected as a result of his qualification. Generally speaking, one took courses in the evening from senior officers who volunteered their time in the various subjects that were on the examination, military law, tactics, the various current affairs, and so on. One studied very hard and worked very hard during those days. Officers generally managed to get a couple of nights off a week, but the rest of the time, if they were ambitious or if they wanted to qualify for Staff College or qualify for promotion, which also required examinations, they did a lot of studying. And as a result of writing the examinations, which were competitive, I came third in the Canadian Army. And
out of how many people would you get in that?
Out of, about 100.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, let's see, it would be, about 100 I would think would be writing. But you were allowed to choose where you wanted to take your Staff College, depending upon your standing in the promotion examination. So I had two people ahead of me, and there were two vacancies at the Staff College, Camberley. And my wife and I were most anxious to go to England. Her family is from the south of England, although she's Canadian herself. And we were looking, just hoping, keeping our fingers crossed, that we would go to England. One of my competitors in the examination who stood first was a chap named Goodspeed, who's a considerable military writer and has written a number of... I'm sorry, I can't remember what his first name is, but Goodspeed has published a number of things. He's a historian of some note, and I've enjoyed reading a number of his books. But mistakenly or not, he decided he wanted to go to Staff College in India. So that gave me one of the two vacancies to Camberley, and I've been eternally grateful to him for making that choice. Now, the Staff College was a very interesting and very intensive one-year course. I suppose the only thing I should mention is that I was captain of the softball team. I think it was a sop they threw to a number of foreign students, because we had two Canadians on the course, we had four Americans on the course, and we had a number of other foreigners who didn't play cricket. So we organized the softball league, and we played softball around England. It was amazing how many teams we found, usually with American Air Force units, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So my big distinction at the Staff College was to be captain of the softball team.
Batting cleanup, no doubt. After...
No, I was promoted to major while I was at the Staff College.
Mm-hmm. After your stint in the Staff College, in, I guess, between 1953 and 56, you were posted to the British Army War Office as a liaison officer in land air warfare. Bearing in mind...
Let's just get to that point, because there's a story I do want to read into this particular record.
Okay.
I was at the Staff College when, of course, King George V or VI died.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an immediate hiatus of 24 hours when everybody was rather shocked. And the next thing I knew, myself and a chap named Mackay, who was the other Canadian who was at the Staff College, were both marched in front of the DAA and QMG, Deputy Assistant Adjutant and Quartermaster General, who was the Senior Administrative Officer of the Staff College. We were solemnly marched in front of him, and he held the Bible out for us. He placed our hands on the Bible, and he read to us the loyal oath, you know, do you faithfully obey, to swear to obey Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and assigns, and so on, whatever the loyal oath was at the period of time. With a perfectly straight face, we were given the loyal oath. We were the only two people in the Staff College that was given the loyal oath. And that didn't happen to British officers, didn't happen to any of the other Commonwealth officers, just the two Canadian officers. So when it was all over, we asked the DAA and QMG, said, why the sudden hurry to re-administer the loyal oath in Queen Elizabeth's name to us? And he looked at us and he said, colonial troops, you know. We subsequently found out, however, that it was a rule, or it was an order that had been issued by Canadian Army headquarters in Ottawa, and it surprised the British officers just as much as it surprised us. I never have found out why we had suddenly had the loyal oath administered to us so quickly while we were there, but there was that.
No kidding, that's very interesting.
That gets